The Motor Talk Podcast with Toby Hagan.
Toby, Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, Melanie. You too.
It's great to have you here.
Great to be back.
So, Toby, we're about to find out what's making news on four wheels with our motoring expert, Toby Hagan. He's here to fill us in on all the latest news in the world of automobiles, to answer your vehicle-related questions. So if you've got something you want to ask Toby, call in. 1-300-800-222 is the number. That's 1-300-800-222 or text, of course, which is 0467-922-702. That's 0467-922-702. Toby, it's a happy new year for you and I sitting here. Oh, before we do anything else, can you just let our listener know a bit about your driving, the few weeks you've done?
Yeah, look, I have spent a fair chunk of the last probably 3 weeks on the road. So started off in Adelaide, through South Australia, Flinders Ranges and so on, with a whole bunch of different cars, four-wheel drives and utes and a lot of outback driving, which I love. I love that sort of driving. A little bit in Victoria and then through New South Wales up to Queensland, up to the southeast end of Queensland for more of a family holiday with that. So I totaled it up and I think there was about 6,000 kilometres all up over the last 3 weeks. Crikey. So I've spent a lot of time on the road, Melanie.
Yeah, and you're so bright-eyed and positive about it. You know, most people that have spent that much time on the road over this time are quite grumpy and quite tired.
Look, there are some elements absolutely that frustrate me. It's typically, I find, once I start getting back into the capital cities and you really start hitting the traffic and you get a lot more aggro on the roads once that traffic starts to kick in. That's when it starts to frustrate me a bit. You just sort of think, this isn't fun. But I love going through, seeing some of the awesome country towns that Australia's got. There's so many people end up just flying over. They just get the cheap flight to whatever, wherever it is they're going. But there's so much you can see along the way that I think's terrific. And the diversity that we've got in this country is phenomenal. And the amount you see and appreciate when you're in a car, I think's great. So, yeah.
And so are you, I'm guessing then that you're not somebody who does the bypass, like that you go into the small towns, do you?
No, it depends. Depends what I'm trying to do. So if I'm trying to get somewhere quickly, I'll often do the bypass and just take that freeway. But look, other times I'll look at a map and say, oh, well, that one's only 20 or 30 Ks more and it looks like a more interesting road. And you end up seeing some towns that, you just don't, you otherwise wouldn't have seen. You've never heard of them, half of them. So it's, I think it's great.
So Toby, when you were out and about this time, were there any sort of issues that you saw happening out there on the roads?
Look, I think one of the bigger issues that we're seeing, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, these 40k an hour limits around emergency services vehicles on freeways. So where you've got to slow to 40 kilometres an hour to go past a police car, for example, that's pulled someone over. Happened to me today on the M1 freeway, the old F3 north of Sydney, and everyone's barreling along at 110. There's a fair bit of traffic. Next thing you know, a police car's there, and the pandemonium it causes trying to knock off 70 kilometres an hour when no one behind you is expecting it. You've got camper vans, you've got trailers, you've got boats, you've got B-double trucks and so on barreling down, and as I said, no one's expecting this, and it causes massive issues. And people are clearly confused about what the rules mean. Some people are confused about it. I just saw a lot of times when – there was one time also it happened to me up near Tweed Heads where I came over a hill. There was a police car that pulled someone over about 100 metres after the hill. I had a car behind me with a boat on the back of it. Again, we're doing 100-odd k's an hour. If I'd done what we were supposed to do, slow to 40 kilometres an hour, there is no question there would have been a crash behind me because there's no way that boat was going to stop at the same speed. So it's madness. It is absolute madness what's going on.
How long has that been the deal?
It came in, I'm trying to think, it was, I'm guessing, 3 or 4 months ago, something like that. So it's and look, the other confusing thing at this time of year is the differences in this rule around Australia. So, for example, in Queensland, you don't have to slow at all for emergency services vehicles. Same with Northern Territory. In Victoria and New South Wales, as I said, you do have to. Western Australia, you also have to. So, there are differences in the rules around the country. South Australia, it used to be, I think it still is, 25 kilometres an hour past emergency services vehicles. So, when you're on a 110 kilometre an hour road, and you've got to knock off that much speed, as I said, people just are not expecting it. It has already caused crashes in some parts of Australia, and there is no doubt it's going to cause more.
Toby, is there a sign up that says go down to 40 kilometres? I had never heard of this until you've just said it.
Has actually been a fair bit of advertising going on about it. In New South Wales, there had been a bit. But no, no signs, no nothing. You're supposed to know when you see those flashing lights that you need to...
Aren't you just meant to move to the side so they can get past? Or this is when
So this is when they're stationary. They're stationary.
Yeah.
And so they might be booking someone for speeding or...
Wow, so you're just meant to, you meant to know to slow down to 40 Ks.
40 Ks an hour, so... and as I said, I mean, on busy multi-lane freeways where trucks are doing 100 kilometres an hour, cars are doing 110, and suddenly you have to do a fairly significant stop to try and wash off 70 kilometres an hour, the trucks aren't expecting it. The trucks cannot slow at anything like the rate that a car can. So it's a big issue. It's a big issue. And it'd be, look, I'm sure other people have seen this going on around the country. And it's, as I said, it happened to me... Probably happened to me three or four times where I had to go past a police car. One of them was absolutely no problem. Two of them, one of them I couldn't stop because, as I said, it would have caused a crash. The second one almost caused a crash, and it was downright dangerous doing it. So, and my understanding is that there are quite a few police as well who are equally as... They're certainly not outspoken about it, but they don't like that it's happening because they see the issues it's causing. Yeah. They see firsthand that there are... you know, there are cars there trying to swerve and dodge and duck, and it's simply not safe.
Toby, it must be impossible to police, though, because if they're stopped with somebody else, how can they come and book you for not slowing down to 40?
Look, it would absolutely be very difficult to police. But, okay, one example. So one of the ones, the one I went past today, he was just finishing up, getting back into his car, and I'm not sure whether the radar would have still been going, and if you could see that cars were going past were doing, you know, 80 k's an hour, 100 k's an hour when they should have been down to 40. So I agree it would be difficult to police, and I think it's unlikely that you would get booked for that reason. But in New South Wales, for example, it's 3 points, $448. So it's a big fine.
Huge fine.
It is. Yeah.
That is so whack. Toby Hagen's with us. Toby is a motoring journalist, author of books, several books, including Kings of the Road, 50 Cars That Drove Australia. And Toby's our resident car expert. If you want to ask Toby a question, you want to call in, text, please do. The number's 1300 800 222. That's 1300 800 222. Toby, the annual vehicle sales figures are going to be released tomorrow. What are we going to see there?
Well, look, we're not going to see a record year. We can guarantee that. The market has been a little bit soft this year, particularly towards the tail end of the year. We've seen, the housing market pretty much take its toll on the new car market. All of a sudden, when people don't have that equity in the house, when they don't have the confidence that their house is rocketing up in value, then all of a sudden they might say, I don't quite need that car now. I'll put the purchase off 6 months, 12 months. So we won't see a record. We will see relatively strong sales. So last year, almost 1.2 million vehicles were sold. We're probably looking at about 20 to 30,000 less vehicles this year, but still a pretty big number. Toyota will be the number one seller again. They'd already clocked over more than 200,000 sales by the end of November, so another month will obviously kick that up further. It'll be interesting to see, I guess, the nuances of who's where. Mitsubishi's had a pretty strong year. Holden's had a very soft year. Given this is the first year since 1948 that Holden hasn't had a locally produced car in its stables. Now, granted, earlier in the year they were getting rid of some of the older Australian-made Commodores, but they've had to rely purely on a purely imported range. So it's a very different time for one of the most iconic brands on the market.
What does that look like into the future for them?
Oh, look, they've still got a lot of challenges ahead for Holden. So it's a brand that has relied so heavily on its Australianness, on its local engineering and local suitability for Australians, but. So now they're just an importer. They've got to try to convince people that they can create the same level of, I guess, suitability for the country that they have done in the past with Australian-made cars, but this time with imported cars. So look, their sales are soft. They have a big job ahead of them in terms of trying to get back on people's shopping lists. So currently they're somewhere around 5% in terms of buyer considerations. So if you look at the overall market, given this is a brand that used to have 50% of the market back in the 1950s, wow. as recently as 15, 20 years ago, they had about 20% of the market. So they've dropped off enormously. So they've got to try and get that back and just get on the shopping list, which is a big challenge.
What's that about? Is that about people taking the family car into having SUVs and stuff like that instead of your Commodore station wagon?
Commodores and Falcons. Yeah, a little bit. It was actually interesting. One of the things you asked about my big road trip and the stuff you learn, and I was taking note of the cars that you see and around the country, and very much on the big tourist routes, all you see pretty much with families is the SUV chocked to the gunnels,
yeah,
and it's,
yeah.
It might have a surfboard on the roof, and it's very much SUV land. Once you get into those sort of sleepier country towns and inland a little bit, I found you started seeing heaps more Ford Falcons and Holden Commodores. They're the cars that they use to do the big distances in. So it's a very different market, I guess. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of people are after different things, and they, you know, in the past have had to cover some pretty big kilometres. In terms of families, families absolutely spinning over to SUVs, and again, the sales figures tomorrow will show that SUVs again are the single biggest vehicle type. About 45% of the market is SUVs, so that's the second year that will have happened. And families have pretty much turned away from those sedans and wagons, and that's where Holden has been a little bit weak in that SUV market. They're coming back strong now. They've got a decent range of SUVs now. But again, just getting on the shopping list. I mean, if you're not even in the consideration set for those sorts of vehicles, then you're no chance of selling one. So you've got to try and muscle back in.
Who's at the top of the list in SUV land?
Well, it depends on which ones you look at. So Toyota sells more SUVs, but a lot of them are the rugged, fallen off-roaders, so your Land Cruiser and Prado and those sorts of things. In terms of your city-based SUVs, Mazda is very strong. So you've got CX-3, CX-5, CX-9 are three of the stronger ones in their respective fields. Look, Toyota's still strong in some, obviously Kluger, RAV4, but Mitsubishi also does reasonably well. They sell very heavily on price, but you look at those three brands and you're looking at a fair chunk of the SUV market.
So the new car market, is it basically SUVs and hatchbacks? Like, is that pretty much majority of the market?
Dual cab utes.
Oh, right.
So this year, Australians will have bought more than 200,000 dual cab utes. So if you look at the overall market, as I said, almost 1.2 million. So roughly one in six vehicle sales, so every type of vehicle, is a ute these days. And the big growth has been in the four-wheel drives, the dual cab four-wheel drives. People are using them as multi-purpose vehicles. They're using them to tow. They're using them to carry the family around. They're sometimes using them for work purposes. They're using them to go off-road. So in some ways, they're a little bit Swiss Army knife. They do a bit of everything, and they're expected to have a pretty broad remit. They don't necessarily do any one of those things superbly, but the fact they can do them all is why so many people are saying, great, I'll grab one of them. And as I said, you know, particularly this time of year, they can load them up, take them up to the camp spot, go four-wheel driving in them and tow the boat up there and whatever else. So
and number one, is it the Hilux?
Hilux is the top seller, but there's been a big battle on the last couple of years between the Hilux and the Ford Ranger. So Hilux very much was the dominant of the ute market. Mm-hmm. Ford Ranger's done exceptionally well in the top end of the market, so the sort of $50,000, $60,000 plus utes. So they've done really well with that. And in many months, they've outsold Toyota in terms of the four-wheel drive version. Mm-hmm. So there's a real battle on there, but no, Hilux will be number one again this year. But it's still very close between them.
And so, Toby, what about hatchbacks? I feel like everywhere I go, I see those little Fiat
500.
Fiat 500. They look like little Beetles a bit. Yeah. They are everywhere.
Yeah, look, there's hatchbacks. Yes, very strong. So if you go back 10, 20 years in terms of small cars, so the small car market generally. Sedans were still very, very strong in Australia, but hatchbacks have taken over. So there's still it tends to be a bit of a generational line between sedan and hatch. So the older generation prefers a sedan. That's, I guess, what they've had all their life, and they like that being able to close the boot, no one can see you, and that sort of thing. But hatchbacks very much towards the younger end of the market, and people like that flexibility, I guess. You know, one thing with a hatch that's great, you can fit a push bike in the back because you can fold the seats down, those sorts of things, which is more difficult in the sedan. So, yeah, look, hatchback's still very strong. But look, I mean, you go back, so Mazda 3, I'm thinking 8 or 9 years ago now, became the first imported vehicle to outsell to become the top selling car in the country. Then Toyota Corolla took over. So those small cars sort of battled it out. In the last few years, as I said, dual cab utes have done well. And so the top two selling cars in the country are the Toyota Hilux and the Ford Ranger. So they're
really?
They outsell Corollas and the whole bit. So
isn't that amazing?
It is, yeah.
Wow. So, I wonder what that says about Australians, like yeah. that we're adventurous types or.
Well, I think we like macho-looking cars.
Yeah, right.
Which is part of the SUV thing too. I mean, they look, you know, if you look at, for most families, bigger families, 3-4-kid-plus families, something like a Kia Carnival, that is pretty much the perfect vehicle for those mm-hmm. families. It's got a heap of space. You can put 8 people in it. Once you've got 8 people in it, you can still have a fair bit of luggage in there as well. These 7-seat SUVs, so your Mazda CX-9s, Toyota Klugers and so on, once you've got 7 people in them, once you've maxed out the seats, you can almost fit no luggage in them. So they're very compromised in that regard. Mm. But people love the fact that they look cool. They're you know, they're a bit of a halfway house for a lot of people, so extremely popular.
Well, we were talking as well before we went to air about last year I did a test drive of a VW Transporter, and it was just with the dream of, you know, converting it into a van and travelling around Australia, Toby, one day. And I just loved the power of it. Yeah. I loved being up high. I loved sort of, I felt very powerful in this car.
Yeah, that's right. So that whole, the higher seating position, I think that is another big one with SUVs. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. One is that that feeling of sitting above the rest of the traffic, getting better visibility. The other one with an ageing population is the hip height, the seat height itself. So instead of having to fall down into the car and sit down quite low and then have to get yourself out when people are getting older, being able to just sort of slide into the car and sort of sit in there and then slide back out is very appealing to a lot of people. So, yeah, for a lot of people, they're the right car at the right time.
Wow, interesting. Should we go to some calls? We've had quite a few calls come in already, Toby. Jeff, good evening to you.
Yeah, mate, good evening. I'd like to agree with Toby on the 40-kilometre-an-hour rule. See, we're up in Queensland. Mm-hmm. We don't have that. I just did a trip down to Victoria.
Yep.
And on the way back, I was coming up through, up around Gundagai somewhere.
Through Hume Highway. But,
mate, it nearly caused pandemonium.
Yeah, it
does. V-doubles and... Well, they're pulling 80-tonne and they will not stop on a dime.
No, that's right. And that's the problem is the big freeways like the Pacific Highway between Sydney and Brisbane, the Hume Highway between Sydney and Melbourne, where you get a lot of trucks and a lot of cars, relatively high speeds, and it is just absolutely crazy what these rules that have come in. And to see it firsthand, and that's something when the rules first came out, I was critical of them and said, I just can't see how this is going to work. Now, having seen it, how it works, or more correctly, doesn't work, that's where you look at it and just say this is just got disaster written all over it. So
I still drive a 1984 Toyota Hilux dual cab ute as well.
All right, soldiering on.
How many Ks have you got on it, Jeff?
525,000.
Wow,
that's amazing.
Done well,
Jeff. Thanks for calling in.
I service it.
Thanks for calling in.
No worries.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Let's go to Heidi now. You've got a question for Heidi tonight, Toby. I mean, sorry. Have a question. Not yet. Heidi, hello.
I'm leaning on the Holden Commodore that's just done its first hour of driving lessons for the brand new license holder. And I'd really like someone other than me to teach him how cars work and how to do general maintenance for just basic stuff. I looked on Google. It's got nothing. Is there anywhere I can send a teenage kid to learn that you do more than put a petrol in a car?
Look, I'm trying to think of where there would be. I'm sure there'd be a course, whether it's a basic TAFE thing or something.
Yeah, couldn't find it.
Yeah, right.
And you would think that people who have to start to drive cars, they're 17, they're about to be responsible for something big and expensive.
Yeah.
That a bit of an idea of how the darn thing works would help, but he's going to have to learn it from his mother, which is going to be tragic.
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting one. I mean, you could do something simple like go and, you know, offer his services at a race team. They're always after, you know, Club Motorsport, for example, they're always after help with that sort of thing. And he'd learn pretty quickly there the basics of what's going on.
I would love to see my Asperger's son working in a race team. That would be hysterical.
Yeah.
I don't think that's quite the spot for him, but I was hoping NRMA ran something or that there was, you're driving a car, therefore you have to know a tiny little bit about it, but
It's a very good point you make in terms of understanding the basics, the mechanics of what's going on in the car with,
it needs water.
Yeah.
It needs oil.
Right. And, I was showing one of my nephews the other day about cleaning out an air filter, for example, because they live on a property and just said, look, you get a lot more dust in there. Here's how you do it as a basic thing. So there's some little things like that you could teach them. Absolutely.
I'll teach him how to change the tyres, but I think he'd rather it wasn't his 52-year-old mother doing it.
Yeah. I dare say there'll be obviously plenty of videos on YouTube and stuff that would teach you the basics of things like changing tyres.
That's how old I am. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. So, things like changing tyres, it'd be pretty easy with that sort of stuff. But it's amazing how many people I think don't know how to change a tyre and how many people don't even know where it is. I remember helping some backpackers a couple of years ago up in the Northern Territory and they had no idea how to even get the spare tyre out. So,
He'll be taught by me if that's what it has to be. But I thought there was somewhere that you could send a bunch of teenagers; they could all hang out, and it'd be cool to learn how to, this is what the engine does, this is why it does that, this is why your mother's going to get ticked off if you don't put oil in the engine, because it is a very old Holden Commodore station wagon.
Heidi, I did a four-wheel driving and off-road course about 10 years ago in the Northern Territory in Darwin, and they taught you all those sorts of things in that, actually, they were teaching you in case you went off-road and you couldn't get fixed.
Had some issues.
Yeah, so maybe would there be any off-road kind of?
Oh, look, there's heaps of off-road courses.
He's got to do 120 hours of practice, but he doesn't have to know a damn thing about the engine.
Well, and look, the other thing that really irks me about the issues with teaching a learner driver. So one is in a lot of instances, bad habits are getting sent back down to kids because they're only getting taught by their parents. But the bigger issue here, I think, with a lot of learner driving is they get that 120, 150, depending on what part of the country you live in, hours of driving behind the wheel with their parents, typically next to them. They're never allowed to do, in somewhere like New South Wales, for example, they're limited to 90 kilometres an hour. And I was listening to ABC Radio about a week or so ago while I was on the road, and it came up, they had a professor on, she was talking about issues with higher speed driving, so why the road toll is quite high in country areas and higher speed driving. So learner drivers, we never let them go above 90 kilometres an hour with their parents safely beside them, giving them tips on what to do. The second we hand them their licence, we allow them to do 100 or 110 kilometres an hour. And so there you go. Off you go. Go a bit faster now that you've got no one there to give you some guidance. And it's ludicrous. It is absolutely ludicrous.
He'll do a course at one of the racetracks before I let him do that.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear.
He gets the slider car. He gets to do all the stupid stuff and find himself
You'll find a lot of those courses, they won't let them go and just do burnouts and wheel spins and stuff. It'll be defensive driving and it'll be teaching them some basics of here's how you do an emergency stop, here's how you look out for other potential hazards on the road. So there's a lot of benefit to that sort of thing, absolutely.
Good luck, Heidi.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Ray, good evening to you.
Oh, how you going there? I just wondered if you'd driven many i30s over your period of time there.
I've driven plenty of i30s, Hyundai i30s. Yeah, absolutely. You're looking to buy one?
No, I've got one. But I must admit, there's one little flaw that they've got.
Go for it.
And that, do you know the A-pillar?
Yep. So the, it for is anyone
a
else
heavy,
out there?
It's
the
a very heavy A-pillar.
Yeah.
And what's the A-pillar?
So the A-pillar is either side of the windscreen. So it's the pillars that sort of join the roof of the car.
It generally is just so heavy that if you're going through pedestrian crossings, you have to be so wary.
Absolutely.
That no one is, you're blocked by someone in the pedestrian. I often go through what's called Croydon Shopping Centre. It's got 5 pedestrian crossings and you just have to be so wary because it blocks out the pedestrians so easily. And I'm just hoping that when they get newer models through, that they actually go with a higher tensile steel to strengthen that area so that they don't have that such a heavier A-pillar because you have to be just so careful.
Yeah. So believe it or not, the i30 isn't one of the worst cars for that. There's plenty worse than that. And anyone who drives a Holden Commodore from 2006 to 2017, any of those model Commodores, they had one of the worst A-pillars of all of them. And look, it is one of the, you look at car design and the technology and so on in cars, and 99% of it has all been a benefit to driving. One of the areas car design has gone backwards is in that A-pillar and visibility generally. Even rear visibility and so on. Mm. It comes down to safety. So the safety regulations, particularly in America, for example, where they have strict rollover requirements, so the car must be able to do a rollover test and it can't crumple more than a certain amount. So they have to strengthen those pillars quite a bit. And size matters when they're trying to strengthen it. So there's been a whole bunch of work done with things like, so Volvo years ago did a concept car where they had it was almost like scaffolding, like it had gaps in there that you could see through.
Yeah.
Other ones are using cameras to try and give you a view of what is behind there, that sort of stuff. So it is absolutely an area that can that is ripe for improvement. So,
Thanks, Ray.
Not a problem.
Safe driving. Bye-bye. And let's go now to John. But before we go to John, I just want to give you the numbers. For some reason, we're not getting any texts. We haven't had one single text tonight. So I suspect that I think the text line might actually be down, but do 0467-922-702. If you've got the capacity to tweet as well, you can tweet me at Melanie Tait, T-A-I-T. And actually, if you've texted us, just send me a tweet and let me know that you've done that, because maybe just no one's texted Toby. I don't believe it. I don't believe that we could have been on air for 32 minutes with no one texting, do you?
Sure. No, absolutely not.
I don't believe it. Even not to tell us how nice we look on the video cam, you know?
That's right.
Yeah. Toby, John's on the line now. Hello, John.
How are you going?
Well, thanks. How are you?
I'm well. I've listened to Toby, every week. This is the first time I've ever called, because I'm looking at trading my car and getting another one.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a 8 to 9 year old Holden Colorado. It's probably one of the first to ever hit the road.
Yeah, replacing the Rodeo back then. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's done 83,000 k's. And it's a petrol 3.6 motor.
Mm-hmm.
It's in really, really good condition.
Mm-hmm.
But I had probably up the bush and everything like that, and I need it for that. So I'm thinking of trading down to quite a small car, because I won't be doing the kilometres I used to do.
Yeah, right. So how much smaller? What's on your shortlist?
Well, I'm 68 years old, so it's got to be a car that's got a bit of height so I can get into it, and a bit of room.
So if you're looking at I know, given what you've just said, this might sound weird, but small cars these days aren't nearly as small as they used to be. Are small cars on the consideration set, or are you sort of next size up?
Yeah. I've been looking at a few, because I go to clubs and that, and I know a lot of people, and they've got smaller cars, so I've had a look at a lot of them, you know.
Yep.
So, and they all give them a good rap.
Yeah.
So something
that could give you a bit of an each way bet. So Subaru Impreza is the latest. Subaru Impreza is a really nice small car in terms of what it does. But if you want something that sits up a little bit higher, for example, in terms of the height of it, then something like the Subaru XV. So it's effectively a Subaru Impreza. So it's exactly the same body, but it sits up a little bit higher suspension. It's got decent space in the back. It's got good space up front, and it is a good, comfortable car for that sort of thing. Subaru Forester's another one. That is bigger again.
Forester.
So Forester, that latest Forester is a terrific car. If you're doing a lot of country driving, it's got a full-size spare tyre, which a lot of those ones don't have these days. So that's an advantage as well. A Mazda CX-5 is also good buying in that market. It doesn't get a full-size spare tyre, so that's a slight issue, but it's also good buying in that mid-sized SUV segment.
I'd like to say this to you, Toby. I appreciate the program. My wife's got a 250C Mercedes.
Yep.
It's not a year old. It's the hardest car for me to get in and out of. It's so low.
So low, yeah, that's right. But once you're there, things like the, in the Mercedes C-Class, even the C-Class, which is their sort of small to mid-sized sedan, you still get a lot of adjustability to that front seat. It's one of the few cars I usually put the seats all the way back, but in that one I don't.
It's a great car. This is her third one.
But, yeah. They're quite low down. Well, that's where, as I said, something like a Forester or a CX-5 will help you. Those are both excellent cars. There's a new Toyota RAV4 coming up. Very distinctive styling. I haven't driven it yet, but yeah, it certainly stands out. Nissan X-Trail is also another interesting one in terms of value and space. So it's one of the bigger of those mid-sized SUVs as well.
Yeah.
Thanks, John.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And guess what? Cameron, our producer, has fixed the text. We've got pages and pages of text, Toby.
How good's that?
Shall we have
Go
a couple now? Okay. So first, let's see. Let's go to a question. Oh, I just had one there. With everyone buying, I had one and then they're updating so quickly, Toby.
They disappeared.
Yeah, that it disappeared. All right. Hi, guys. I'm seriously looking at buying a VW Ayrton. I don't know if that's Ayrton.
Arteon.
Yeah. Wondered what your thoughts are, especially the ride with 20-inch wheels. That's from Keeley.
Yeah, so look, anything with low-profile tyres on pretty average Australian roads is going to struggle a little bit. That said, the Arteon doesn't do a bad job considering what it's trying to do. If you're comparing it with, say, a bog-stock Toyota Camry, then no, the ride isn't going to be as good. But the trade-off is quite capable dynamics on that car. So it does have a really sporty, athletic type of feel to it. And it's a terrific looking car, both inside and out. And it comes loaded with equipment. Not exactly cheap. So it's one of these sort of fringe players that you're starting to get sort of trying to bolster the gap between your mainstream models and your luxury cars. And that Arteon really plays in that at the sort of high $60,000 mark. It's trying to grab a little bit of attention from that luxury market, but yeah, not quite, not with the full-on luxury price tag. So in terms of the ride, as I said, if you're doing a lot of driving on B-grade country roads, you're going to notice it, absolutely. It'll jiggle around a little bit more, particularly that initial impact harshness over the bumps, but it's not what I'd call a harsh vehicle. And from memory, it does come with adjustable dampers, so you can leave them in their softest setting and at least get a little bit more suppleness there to the suspension. So yeah.
And Toby, Adele wants to know, we need to tow a 3-ton caravan. What would you recommend?
Ooh, this is really tricky because most of those dual cab utes are rated at 3.5-ton towing capacity, and they'll do it. But you're working the engine pretty hard. And these days I've heard of injector problems, for example, which when they happen can be quite expensive to fix. So not going to happen after driving a little bit. But if you're doing many thousands of kilometres, I'd almost be trying to look at something with a bit more grunt. So something like a Jeep Grand Cherokee, you can get some bigger engines in those, and a 3-litre diesel, V6 diesel, for example, which might do a good job. It's rated at 3.5 tonnes. But a Toyota Land Cruiser will do it easily. It's obviously much bigger vehicle, more expensive vehicle, 3.5-ton towing on it. So, but yeah, you're paying a lot more for it. So I guess to answer the question, if I was heading off around the country and I'm towing a 3-ton van and I'm doing it for a year or two, I probably would stretch to something like a Land Cruiser. If you're just taking it away once every now and again, you know, in the holidays, once or twice a year, then any of those dual cab utes, as I said, will do the job. 3-ton starts to max out a lot of the SUVs. So things like Ford Everest, Toyota Prado all tend to top out at that 3-ton mark. So so you're right on the limit there, and you've only got to put, you know, a bag of chips in the back and suddenly it's over the right weight limit. So the dual cab utes tend to make more sense in that regard. So
We've got Pat on the line. Hello, Pat.
Hello, how are you both tonight?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. And Happy New Year to both of you.
Happy New Year, Pat.
Toby, I'm looking at maybe getting a small SUV type vehicle.
Yep.
I was wondering what you thought of the Suzuki Vitara.
Excellent value. So in terms of it's one of the bigger ones of those small SUVs. Its interior is probably a little bit down market in terms of the overall presentation, but the way it's put together is exceptional, and the equipment they've thrown at it is also very good. So in terms of value for money, a terrific little car. And look, Suzuki's have a fantastic reputation for longevity and going a long way without having many issues. So, all things added up, I'd absolutely stick that high on the list if you can live with, the interior that just is a little bit more plastic than some of the competition. Things like Mazda CX-3 has quite a nice interior, nowhere near the space of that Vitara, but it's a more nicely presented interior. We touched on that Subaru XV before, which that would also be on my shortlist to go and have a look at one of those. And what else would there be? I reckon they're probably the top ones. Vitara is certainly great value.
Thanks very much, Pat. And let's go to, we've got a text from Peter. Your opinion on Holden 2017 VF SV6 Commodore, please.
Look, great. In terms of the last of those Australian-made Commodores, look, they'd certainly nailed it by the end. If it was my money, I'd probably stretch it a little bit to try and get the V8 because those last V8s were just great. But look, the SV6 was also a great car. We actually took a VF Commodore, did a lap of Australia in it. This was in about 2013 or 14, something like that. And the ease with which it did it and the comfort and, the overall suitability for those sorts of roads was just fantastic. So, in terms of if you get it for the right price, absolutely.
Toby Hagen is with us. And if you've just joined us, Toby is a motoring journalist. He's the author of books such as Kings of the Road, 50 Cars That Drove Australia. And he's our resident car expert. If you want to ask him a question, call 1300 800 222 or text 0467 922 702. Text line is absolutely working. Now, we've had a text from Phil, Toby, who says, "Hey, Toby, please tell me why Toyota won't bring back the Corolla wagon. I heard you sing the praise of the Passat wagon recently, and there hasn't been a Corolla wagon since 2006. SUVs aren't the be-all and end-all, and the online forums are crying out for the Corolla wagon to be introduced."
Indeed. So wagons generally have fallen off the radar with a lot of Australians. So there are still some that come out. Volkswagen's one, as you said, Passat. The Golf wagon is still here. Ford has just started selling the fourth generation, I think it is, Focus, and that now has a wagon for the first time. So a Ford Focus wagon. But the reason we're not seeing these wagons, and you touched on it in the text, is SUVs. So the short story is, car makers know they can bring out an SUV and they get lapped up. There are plenty of people out there looking to buy them, whereas with wagons, there are nowhere near as many people. Yes, there are some, and some people say, "I absolutely want a wagon." And when you start analysing those wagons, they do make a lot of sense. They have very good packaging efficiency, so that the space they get out of the interior of them is often a lot better than what you'll get in an SUV. So Mazda 6 is another one of those mid-size wagons that's out there as well. So, but look, I wouldn't hold your breath for a Corolla wagon. They, to my knowledge, have got no plans for it. They're very much switched over to convincing people to buy a Toyota RAV4 instead. So it's which is what most of the car makers are doing. But as I said, if you're looking for a small wagon, Golf or Focus would be the two to look at.
Let's hear from Nicholas now. Hello, Nicholas.
Good evening. Enjoying your talk.
Oh, great. What would you like to ask Toby, Nicholas?
Now, I'm a bit off track. I'm wanting to build a small business selling artisanal food produce from around Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yum.
So that's going to involve driving around initially places like Tasmania, Victoria, South Australia and New South Wales. Queensland's getting a bit too far. But yeah. I'd be away for a week at a time and I'm going to need to buy stuff and store it on board. And I'm also going to need to have an internal fridge. So I'm thinking of something like an old troop carrier.
Oh, wow.
I am on a budget, so I want to go as far back as I'll get a reliable vehicle. And I'm pretty handy, so I can do a lot of the fixing work myself. I'm also wondering if it's worth getting something that's broken down and replacing the engine and the gearbox with a four-wheel drive.
So do you need four-wheel drive? Are you going to be going off-road?
Look, I'd like to have four-wheel drive because I'd like to. I really enjoy seeing going off the beaten track, so I might not need that to get the food.
Yeah.
But while I'm on my journey, I'd like to take a detour for maybe half a day and have a look at things.
Yeah, wow. Because the only reason I say that is because it can... Well, those 70 series Land Cruisers, the Troopies and so on, are incredibly good at what they do, and what they do very well is going off-road. In terms of on-road, they're extremely compromised. So their general comfort levels, the handling and so on is not that great. They're just not, that's not their reason for being. Their reason for being is paddocks and outback areas and so on. So I'd be aware of that. If most of your driving is on-road, I don't know whether you can... forgo the having a look around. But if you're sold on something like that, Look, absolutely reliable and so on, but yeah, I mean, that's, you know, in terms of changing engines and transmissions, a lot of people on those 70 series Land Cruisers, as you probably know, they're manual only. A lot of people will fit an automatic transmission. There are companies around that do those. People who upgrade from the old inline six cylinders to the V8s, and in some cases throw a Chevy V8 in there or something as well. So there's a lot of options there in terms of modifications that you can do with those vehicles. And they'll generally do a good job at it. But as I said, everything is focused on that vehicle with going off-road, and for on-road, it'll be a compromised mobile.
Thanks, Nicholas. Let's go to Victor now. Victor, what would you like to ask Toby?
Right. Toby, good evening, and thank you for taking the call. I've been driving a BMW 3 Series for 15 years.
Yep.
But I need to get, a bad neck, a mid-height car.
Yep.
So that it's not easy to slide in, not climb up and not climb down.
Yep.
And I've been looking very carefully. I've had three test drives of Kia Sportage and the Mazda, including the new Mazda CX-5, including the new
turbo.
Dual turbo.
Yep.
And the Kira. And I'm torn between the two. The family's driving me mad to make my mind up. And I said, I can't quite decide yet. And also, if I'm going to buy a model year 19, should I wait till March and get one that was actually made in 19 rather than made in 18? Well, I don't normally sell cars. We keep them and pass them over, but in terms of value.
Okay. Let's touch on that one first, the model year one first up. So obviously this time of year, any car you're buying now will be a 2018 model. And for the next couple of months, you're going to start getting cars on dealer lots that will be sold, legally sold as a 2019 model, but if you pop the bonnet and have a look, they'll actually be built in 2018. So the build plate, when it rolled off the production line, is 2018, but it will have an Australian compliance plate, so when it came out of customs in Australia, a 2019 plate. When you go to sell that car, that 2019 compliance, 2018 build will be valued as a 2018 model. So it's effectively a year old, even though it's only a month or two older than anything else. So keep that in mind. That said you don't tend to sell them. You tend to hand them down to other family members and so on. So that's not going to be an issue in that case. The cars themselves are identical. So it's literally when it rolled off the production line. In terms of which car to get between a Sportage and a CX-5, I would put the CX-5 ahead of the Sportage. It is a better presented interior. It's a nicer driving car, particularly, the diesel engine's great, but in those cars, most people are going petrol. But I would also stick Subaru Forester on the list just to really confuse you and probably annoy your family members, because it'll take you longer to make a decision. But I'd be choosing between Forester and CX-5 would be my two in that market.
Thanks very much, Victor. Good luck.
And I thank you very much for the very sound advice.
Thank you. Let's go to Di now. Hello, Di.
G'day. This is Di in West Footscray in sunny Melbourne. Bit of an old romantic. I quite like a road trip, and I especially like it in a camper van. I've rented a few over the years, but I very much like the idea of buying my own van, and I can do the fit out myself one way or another. Seems to be that either a Toyota Hiace or a Nissan Ervan are the models of choice.
Yep.
Toyota Hiace is plentiful around.
Yeah.
A couple of questions. I had an aunt, showing my age, who had a Toyota Hiace camper van. Something broke down with it, and her model wasn't as cheap to repair as what she had thought, because it wasn't Australian made, it was made in Asia.
Yep.
So would you be steering me towards an Australian made one because it would be cheaper for parts and servicing?
Yep.
What is a long wheelbase? That seems to come up often.
Yep.
I want to get as much bang for my buck as I can.
Another whole bit.
Well, an extra foot, you know, is the difference between having a short boyfriend and a tall boyfriend in the bed.
Indeed. So wheelbase.
It's important when you're travelling around Australia, Di.
Hey, I like a tall man. What can I say?
So wheelbase is the distance between the front wheels and the rear wheels. So it's just a straight measurement between there. As a really general rule, the more space you've got between those wheels, obviously in a van, it's going to make it a bigger van inside. In a regular passenger car, it roughly translates to rear leg room. So you'll find your limousines and so on have got quite a long wheelbase, whereas your small cars have got quite a short wheelbase. But so effectively, the long wheelbase is going to be, it's going to be a longer vehicle than the regular ones. But the Toyota also does the SLWB. So that's the, I think,
I have pen at hand. What was it, an SL?
SL, so it's S long wheelbase. So I think it's super long wheelbase or something. It's longer again. So so you get an even bigger one. But effectively,
an even taller boyfriend.
Yeah, that's right. So it'll as I said, it just translates to a longer tray inside, more space to put bigger beds, better washing machines, whatever you're going to throw in it. So it's
in a camper van, not of this vintage. are there some Toyota Hiace models which have fared better over the years?
So the current Hiace is, I'm guessing, 15-odd years old, something like that. It's been around for an awfully long time, and it is due for replacement, I would imagine, in the next couple of years. So it's been around a long time. In that time, they update things like they'll update the so-called jewellery on the car, the grills and so on, to make it look snazzier. They also put a new engine in from memory at one point. These days, a lot of them are diesel, whereas they used to be more petrols. You touched on before about Australian made. None of them are made in Australia, unfortunately. So that's not going to help
never.
You.
Never. Toyota Hiace never made.
I'm just trying to think. Certainly not in the last 25, 30 years. So none of the ones you're looking at will have been made in Australia. They're all imported. So and same with all the rivals for that matter. So the any of those rivals you're looking at are all from overseas. So Australia pretty much focused on large cars for decades. So what
might your top tip be for a girl who doesn't necessarily know a lot about cars, but could confidently fit it out as far as the camper van bit goes?
Well, look, I'm not a massive fan of the Hiace because it's such an old design and because of the compromises with, you're effectively sitting on the engine and it's...
This is very controversial, you know.
It is. It's
not well done in the way that they do it. So I don't find them particularly comfortable to be in. They're a work vehicle. They sell fairly largely on the reputation and the reliability and so on, that whole reputation that Toyota's got. So I would actually be looking at something like a Hyundai iLoad, which is just another basic van. iLoad. So it's a fairly basic van. Look, in terms of, you're looking at secondhand, not you, is that right?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say the current Ford Transit is the top of those vans at the moment. It's the best one, but you're not going to have many on the used car market. So a Hyundai iLoad is just a good value, decent van. It came with a 5-year warranty. It's if you can get a 3 or 4 year old one, it sounds like you might be going older again, but they're a better thing than the Hiace, all things considered. That said, they weren't as popular for those sort of camper van conversions and so on.
What's the definition of a better van, though? What's your definition?
So better driving position, better to drive, so better handling and so on, a nicer diesel engine, and, things like that. So it's it ticks a lot of boxes.
The cat amongst the pigeons.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. Good. Happy 2019, both of you.
Happy 2019, Di. Good luck. You're living the dream going on the road in a van.
I'm planning the dream. I'm not yet living it.
Good on you, Di. Well, keep us posted. Thanks so much.
Thanking you for the offer. Bye-bye.
And I've had a text from Megan who wants to know... Of course, these texts just keep going so quickly. She says it's decision time, Mazda CX-5 versus Honda HR-V.
Well, so they're actually cars in two slightly different classes. Not that that really matters, but the direct competitor to the CX-5 is the Honda CR-V. The HR-V is slightly smaller. So you'll get a bit more space in the CX-5. If that's important to you, go for that. The CX-5 would be a better vehicle all round, but it'll also be a bit more expensive. So the HR-V, you're not going to have to pay quite as much for. But if you want to... just a really simple sum it up, I'd say CX-5 ahead of the HR-V.
And we've got Jenny on the line. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good.
I'll be looking, say, mid-next year for a new car, and I was looking at a smaller car, but trying to look outside the square, and I've been looking at the MG. There's an MG ZS, yep. There's an Excite and an Essence, and I don't really know too much about them. We don't hear much about them. I understand they're made in China, so just, you know, curious to know anything about the vehicles.
Yeah, cool. So MG has nothing to do with the MG that most
Correct.
People imagine, those sports cars that came out of England. As yep. you pointed out, they're out of China. They're owned by China's biggest vehicle maker, a company called SAIC, or S-A-I-C.
Okay.
So it's one of the brands. And so another SAIC brand that's sold in Australia is LDV. You might see some LDV yep. vans and so on around. So they're exactly the same company. So MG... yeah, as I said, if you're thinking sports car and so on, it's nothing like that. The MGs that are sold here now, they do hatchbacks, they do small SUVs, and that little ZS, the small SUV,
yep.
it's okay. It's nothing special. The engine is underpowered. And it also needs things like premium unleaded, which is a little bit unusual in that market. And things like resale value are just not going to be there. So there are not people there queuing up to buy secondhand MGs that look like
yep.
four-wheel drives.
Yep.
So be very aware of all that sort of stuff. The
yep.
cars themselves are surprising in terms of, they feel a bit cheap in some areas, but they're not too bad. They are, they're all right little cars, but
kind of like no
special.
Frills. No frills.
Yeah, no frills, absolutely. So
yep.
it's there are probably better things you can look at in that small SUV market, but
cool.
you know, prices often
yep.
the MG undercuts them. So
thanks,
yeah.
Jenny.
Cool. Not a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And Russ, what would you like to ask?
G'day, Toby. I beg your pardon. Who am I talking to?
It's Toby and Melanie.
Oh, Melanie. I'm sorry, darling.
Hi, Russ. Happy New Year to you too.
Look, a couple of previous callers ago looking for a camper van. That lady, she was talking about a Toyota camper van.
Yeah.
Look, I'm available. I'm tall and I'm secondhand, so if you'd like to give me my number.
Excellent.
Look, I'm looking at a 2015 Toyota Yaris, hatchback.
Yep.
It's got a 1300 motor. It's done a little over 60K.
Yep.
And I'm wondering what I'm considering buying that. For a small car to get around. I live in a regional town. Actually, I'm in Wodonga.
Yep.
And I only need to get around town to do my shopping and something with air conditioning in it to get me to and from without breaking into a sweat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
I wonder what you would say, Toby, about what you would comment about its reliability, longevity, and parts availability into the future. I probably want to keep it for 4 or 5 years.
So all those sorts of factors, excellent on a Yaris. So they sold a lot of them. So even once Toyota runs out of spare parts, you'll find plenty in wrecking yards and so on. So I wouldn't have any issue at all trying to find spare parts for it. Access to parts obviously is good. Toyota's got the widest network, the widest dealer network in the country. The 1.3 engine was a little bit underpowered. It's only, if you're looking at an automatic version, it's only hooked up to a 4-speed automatic, whereas most rivals had 5 and in many cases 6-speed automatics. So living in Albury, Wodonga, you're obviously going to hit the freeway every now and again. So having more gears is going to be a better bet. So, look, a good car for the sorts of things you're looking for, good reliability, good access to parts, but there are probably a few that would be nicer if you can get them for the money. Things like Suzuki Swift, Kia Rio, and Honda Jazz are also worth having a look at. Those three are also going to tick a lot of those boxes as well, but give you a slightly more exciting car in some ways.
Good luck, Ross. Thank you for calling in. We are just about to go to the news now. Toby Hagen, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Toby Hagen, motoring journalist, author of Kings of the Road, 50 Cars That Drove Australia, our resident car expert, will be back with you in a fortnight's time.